From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Kiev suffering reversals in eastern Ukraine, Kenyan police intensifying a security crackdown, Ethiopia's military most powerful in sub-Saharan Africa, plus the latest on the search for that missing Malaysian passenger plane. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine's efforts to restore order in the troubled eastern part of the country didn't go so well on Wednesday when pro-Russian separatists were seen atop several Ukrainian army vehicles hoisting Russian flags. Jamie Detmer in Kiev is following the story.
The column of six armored personnel carriers was seized in the city of Slavansk on the eve of talks in Geneva between diplomats from Russia, Ukraine and the West. The action is adding to frustrations here in Kiev about the failure of the country's new leaders to reassert control in the east. Kiev authorities deny claims by locals that Ukrainian paratroopers manning the troop carriers switched sides after agitators offered them food. Separatists say the soldiers' morale was low and that they hadn't been given supplies for several days. Ukrainian defense officials say the column was captured with the help of Russian agents. Kiev insists that hundreds of Russian troops have crossed the border and are coaching and instructing separatists on tactics. The allegation is dismissed by Moscow. Ukraine's new leaders, who replaced President Viktor Yanukovych in February after months of street protests against his pro-Russian rule, are trying to dampen ethnic Russian agitation in East Ukraine by offering reforms and greater autonomy to the region. They're also trying to respond cautiously to the seizure in recent days by pro-Russian militants of government and security buildings in at least 10 towns in eastern Ukraine. They fear that too strong an action will offer the Kremlin a pretext to order in an estimated 40,000 Russian troops massed on the border. Kiev's politicians claim Moscow has been infiltrating Russian provocateurs for weeks to incite unrest in eastern Ukraine, an allegation also leveled by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. The Kremlin denies this, but has warned it is ready to send its forces across the border to protect ethnic Russians. Similar warnings were issued before Russia took control in the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
A Ukrainian envoy says he's hopeful four-way Ukraine talks today in Geneva will deter further Russian military aggression in his country, but he warns Ukraine will do whatever it takes to protect its territory if diplomatic efforts fail to resolve the standoff. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
Foreign ministers from the United States, European Union, Russia, and Ukraine are to hold crisis talks Thursday in an effort to prevent the standoff between Russia and Ukraine from spiraling out of control. Ukrainian ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Yuri Klimenko, says it will not be easy to restore stability in his country, nor to get Russia to back off from its territorial designs. But he says he believes the talks could find a way to work toward a peaceful settlement. The ambassador says the issue of the federalization of Ukraine is not on the talks agenda. He says his government is committed to decentralization, to granting more power to the different regions. But he says the government opposes Russia's demand Ukraine become a federalized state, which is seen as a ploy by Moscow to weaken the role of the central government in Kiev.
This meeting will not consider the issues pertaining to the internal affairs of Ukraine, but measures for the escalation of pressure on the borders of Ukraine, as well as ways for resuming trade and economic relations between Ukraine and Russia based on mutually profitable market principles. Ukraine is persistently opposing efforts by Moscow to disrupt Geneva talks under any concocted pretexts.
He says Ukraine considers negotiations as the only option for settling conflict. But he tells VOA, if Russia continues its aggressive actions, Ukraine is ready to use all means of self-defense, according to Article 51 of the UN Charter. This article gives states the right to take up arms.
If there will be an aggression, a blatant aggression against Ukraine, against its eastern and southern regions, so Ukraine will use its right of self-defense. I'm telling you as a diplomat, not only the Ukrainian army will defend the country, but every Ukrainian will defend its motherland.
The foreign ministers hope their combined diplomatic effort Thursday will succeed in breaking the logjam between Moscow and Kiev. But if there is no breakthrough, the United States and European Union have threatened to impose more economic sanctions on Russia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Relations between the United States and Russia have hit a low point since Moscow annexed Crimea. Looking into whether the two sides are returning to a Cold War, here's VOA's senior correspondent, Andrei Dineshnera.
The Cold War lasted roughly from the end of World War II in 1945 to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Georgetown University professor Charles Kupchin says the Cold War was a rivalry between a Western bloc led by the United States and an Eastern bloc led by the Soviet Union.
It was defined by ideological competition, a communist system versus a capitalist system, an autocratic system versus a democratic system, and it was defined by traditional geopolitical rivalry for dominance both over the military-industrial heartland as well as over proxies in the developing world.
Since the demise of the Soviet Union, memories of the Cold War have faded. But there is talk now of a new Cold War following Russian President Vladimir Putin's annexation of Ukraine's peninsula, Crimea. During a speech in Brussels, President Barack Obama dismissed the notion of a new Cold War.
This is not another Cold War that we're entering into. After all, unlike the Soviet Union, Russia leads no bloc of nations, no global ideology.
President Obama also described Russia as a regional power that is threatening some of its immediate neighbors, not out of strength, but of weakness. Kupchin agrees, saying Russia is not what it used to be.
During the Cold War, Russia had millions of soldiers under arms. It had a world-class navy. It had proxy client states around the world. That is not the Russia that we have today. Russia today has 750,000, 800,000 men under arms. Its navy is a sad shadow of what it used to be. It has very few allies in the world. And it's for that reason, I think, that a return to the Cold War is not on. Russia doesn't really have what it takes.
But Columbia University Professor Emeritus Robert Legvold has a different view.
I believe we're already in a new Cold War. That's not a majority view. I think most people are reluctant to think that we could fall again into something as large, complicated, dangerous, with particularly the shadow of nuclear Armageddon as we had in that 50-year period earlier.
Legvold says some of the essential characteristics of the Soviet Union's relationship with the West during that period are true of the relationship between Russia and the West today.
Well, first of all, rather than the ambiguous sense of the other side that both the U.S. and Europe had of Russia for much of the last 20 years, that is sort of neither friend nor foe, something in between, but not quite clear what, reciprocated by the Russians, who thought of the West in much the same terms, that's disappeared. And you see each side now literally not only defining the other side as an adversary, but calling it such in the speeches that we've had from major leaders and pundits in the press.
Legvold says another sign of a new Cold War is that, in his view, officials in Washington and Moscow have apparently given up on the idea of working towards a fundamentally different cooperative relationship.
The assumptions that underlay the Obama administration's reset, for example, they've now disappeared, been replaced by the notion that the most we can hope for are momentary, quite specific, quite limited transactions that may be cooperative, but not something that adds up to a level of cooperation that begins to lead us toward genuine and durable partnership.
Many experts believe a genuine and durable partnership could only be achieved with new leaders in Washington and Moscow. Andrei Dineshnera, VOA News, Washington.
And you can keep up to date on what's happening in Ukraine, plus today's Geneva summit, by going to our website. We're at voanews.com.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan will meet with his National Security Council today after suspected militants carried out a string of deadly attacks and abducted more than 100 schoolgirls. Late Wednesday, Nigeria's Joint Information Center said only 8 of the abducted students were still missing. In a statement, Nigeria's defense director said one of the terrorists who carried out the school attack had been captured. There were no initial claims of responsibility, but the assault is similar to attacks that have been carried out by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Kenyan police say they have screened more than 1,000 people and are deporting 225 others in ongoing security sweeps targeting illegal immigrants. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports that rights groups and ethnic Somalis in Kenya have complained of police harassment, bribe-taking, and ethnic targeting during the crackdown.
In a statement Wednesday, Kenyan police said the security sweep known as Operation Usalama Watch, which began earlier this month, has progressed well and has been intensified. Police officers have been going door to door across the country, arresting and screening suspected illegal immigrants. Police spokesman Masoud Mouini delivered an update on the operation at a news conference in Nairobi.
Operation Usalama Watch has continued to arrest criminals, suspected terrorists, and illegal aliens. 1,136 suspects from 14 different nationalities have undergone security screening as of April 15.
In addition, police say 225 people are in the process of being deported. This includes 82 previously sent to Mogadishu, while refugees are being sent back to camps in northern Kenya. The country has been on high alert following recent attacks and threats by Somali militants. Security operations have focused on ethnic Somali neighborhoods in the capital, Nairobi. Kenyan Somali political activist Awil Aden Ahmed says Somali residents feel they have been vilified.
All Somalis see that this has been a target to their population, a target to their business. So they see this is a total war against Somalis.
Mouini disputes the allegations that any particular group is being singled out.
At the end of the day, this operation is well intended. It is not punitive, and it is in no way trying to target people.
Somalis in Nairobi have accused police of seeking bribes during security sweeps, threatening to arrest legal residents if they do not pay up. Mouini says he has heard accounts of police misconduct, but has yet to see an official report. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
And about 400 Ugandan troops will be deployed to Somalia under a new United Nations Guard unit charged with protecting the UN staff and installations in that violence-prone Somali capital, Mogadishu. Lieutenant Colonel Patty Ankunda is the Ugandan military spokesperson.
UNGU is the United Nations Guard unit in Somalia. Their mandate is different from that of the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM. Theirs will be to provide static security to UN personnel and installations, and also provide escort and other security-related issues.
Uganda's military has long been involved in Somalia, where their soldiers lead the UN-backed AU force that's helping government troops to keep the militant group Al-Shabaab at bay. Chad said Wednesday it had withdrawn its entire force of more than 800 troops from the Central African Republic in the wake of accusations by the United Nations that Chadian troops had opened fire in a crowded market in the capital Bangui on March 29th in an attack that left around 30 people dead. UN Human Rights Commission said an investigation had found that the troops fired without any provocation. Chad said the accusation was defamatory. The Chadian troops have faced repeated accusations of siding with Muslims in the CAR's bloody sectarian conflict. The mainly Muslim Salika and the Christian Antibalaka militias have been engaged in increasing violence. A defense website has ranked Ethiopia's armed forces as the most powerful in sub-Saharan Africa, slightly stronger than those in South Africa. Peter Heinlein has the story.
The annual worldwide rankings published by the Global Firepower website place Ethiopia as the 40th most powerful military in the world, just ahead of South Africa at 41st. Nigeria ranked 47th, Kenya was 63rd. Egypt remains easily the most powerful armed force on the entire continent. The Egyptian military is ranked 13th in the world, alongside such traditional powers as Pakistan, Brazil, Italy, and Israel. To get a bit of perspective on the balance of power in Eastern Africa, we turn to James Hackett, a military analyst specializing in the Horn of Africa at the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. Hackett says Ethiopia has made impressive strides in modernizing its armed forces, focused mainly on its heavy deployment along its border with Eritrea.
The modernization is broad, related to personnel. It's also related to equipment. Ethiopia does boast some relatively modern capabilities, T-72 main battle tanks, SU-27 flankers, for instance. But the present force is sized. The army, I think, is around 135,000. So a lot of that sized, that standing force, to maintain the deployments on the border with Eritrea because of the domestic security priorities. So being able to deliver a force that can sustain overseas, for instance, or sustained operations abroad, still remains a challenge. But Ethiopia, I think, has long addressed that in a way and gained experience from its long history of UN peacekeeping operations on the continent.
Hackett says, while the Global Firepower website rankings are interesting, it's impossible to tell in real terms whether Ethiopia has passed South Africa in overall military capability.
South African armed forces are a very modern force with niche capabilities that aren't possessed by other states in its part of the continent. Nigeria's armed forces are relatively modern and modernizing as well. Regionally, yes, it's a relatively powerful armed force, but you know, Kenyan armed forces have developed as well, as I was saying, in recent years. Uganda's also acquired more modern capabilities. So it's relatively powerful within the region, but it's difficult to sort of say in terms of the continent what's the most powerful armed force.
While the Global Firepower Survey did not include Eritrea, James Hackett says its military should not be underrated. He told VOA that while Eritrea's tank forces may be older than Ethiopia's, Asmara's air force has been updated.
And in terms of the land forces, what we see in terms of main battle tanks, for instance, in Eritrea, is generally older, quite a few of them. You know, older can still mean pretty good, depending on who the adversary is. But if you compare that, say, with the Ethiopians, they double the number, and we assess about 200 T-72s, which are fairly modern Russian-origin main battle tanks. So you'd think in some ways then that would tell a story in and of itself, but then the Eritrean Air Force, for instance, is modernized with MiG-29 flankers, Fulcrums rather, SU-27 flankers. So the Air Force has undergone more of a modernization process than the Army.
The International Institute for Security Studies' James Hackett also noted that Ethiopia's effort to create a more ethnically balanced armed force has required large numbers of ethnic Tigrayans to retire from the military. He praised Addis Ababa's stated intention to raise the representation of other ethnic and religious groups into the military, but said it's too early to tell what the outcome will be. He told VOA, it's a work in progress. Peter Heinlein, VOA News, Washington.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Saudi Arabia's intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, has been removed from his post at his own request, according to the Saudi state media. We get more now from Edward Uranian in the VOA Middle East Bureau.
حسم الأمر الملكي السعودي ما كان مجرد تسريبات صحفية حول إخراج بندر بن سلطان.
The news that Prince Bandar bin Sultan is being replaced as Saudi intelligence chief was cheered by his arch enemies, including Iran and its top allies, Syria and Lebanon's Hezbollah. Iran's Al Alam TV blamed the prince for supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria and attributed his political demise to his failure to defeat Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The 65-year-old prince is being replaced by his deputy, General Yusuf al-Idrisi. Bandar had been spearheading Saudi efforts to unseat President Assad in the bitter and bloody Syrian civil war, supporting various Sunni rebel factions. But he came under criticism for supporting al-Qaeda, prompting King Abdullah to wrest Syria operations away from him in February, handing them to Interior Minister Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. American University of Beirut professor Hilal Kashan has written about Prince Bandar and tells VOA that supporting al-Qaeda is a sore spot in the kingdom.
There was a prelude to dismissing him. A few months ago, the Saudis announced that they would put on trial any Saudi fighting in Syria. And Bandar invested in supporting al-Qaeda in Syria. He wanted to get rid of the Syrian regime at any cost, even to the point of working with al-Qaeda. So the moment the Saudis decided to ban Saudis from going to Syria, it became clear that Bandar's approach to Syria has failed and that Saudis were about to alter their policy on Syria.
Kashan says it took Saudi Arabia 10 years to evict al-Qaeda from Saudi soil, so many Saudi princes were angry over Bandar's support for the group in Syria, which they feared would ultimately come back to haunt them. He says Bandar frequently clashed with other members of the royal family.
He fell from grace because obviously he failed in Syria. Since 2006, when he was appointed as the kingdom's intelligence boss, he disappeared from the scene four times, mainly because he kept clashing with members of the royal family. He's a difficult person, and I understand he is arrogant, and he was sent abroad on the pretext of seeking medical service.
Prince Bandar's relations with the United States have been rocky, and he has reportedly threatened on several occasions to effect a major shift away from the Saudi kingdom's long alliance with Washington. Bandar has reportedly criticized the Obama administration for not supplying Syrian rebels with heavy weaponry. The prince was a well-known figure in Washington, where he served as Saudi ambassador to the United States for nearly 30 years. He also had close ties to former presidents George W. Bush and his father, George H.W. Bush. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A mini submarine hunting for the wreckage of a missing Malaysian airliner in the southern Indian Ocean has completed its first full mission at the third attempt. The Australian agency coordinating the search said the U.S. Navy sub retrieved seabed data, which is being analyzed. Demanding face-to-face regular meetings with Malaysian government officials and answers to their questions about the search for the jetliner, relatives of the 153 Chinese passengers who were on board the Boeing 777 walked out of a video conference with high-level Malaysian officials in Kuala Lumpur.
You have absolutely no shame. You're all bloody liars and you're lying to us again now.
Meantime, Malaysia's acting transport minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, told reporters the search for missing Flight 370 will not be lessened in any way.
I think as far as Malaysia is concerned, and I can only speak for Malaysia, we will not scale down. And this is a promise that I've made to the families of the passengers, and we will continue.
A Malaysian Airlines plane disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing back on March 8th. 239 people were aboard. And a portrait of Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani schoolgirl shot in the head by the Taliban, expected to bring $80,000 at a charity auction at Christie's next month. She hopes to use the money to help Syrian refugees in Jordan and girls in Pakistan who have been attending labor camps. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. And the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On April 17th, 1492, Christopher Columbus signed a contract with Spain to find a new route to Asia. In 1895, the Treaty of Shimonoseki between China and Japan was signed. It marked the end of the First Sino-Japanese War. The war ended in a stunning victory for Japan. China was forced to renounce its claims to Korea and Taiwan, as well as other territory. On this day in 1961, the CIA began an ill-fated invasion of Cuba in a failed operation to overthrow the communist government of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. The Bay of Pigs invasion ended up as an embarrassment to the new U.S. president at the time, John F. Kennedy. In 1969, the architect of Czechoslovakia's Prague Spring, Alexander Dubček, was forced to resign. The Soviet Union feared Dubček's program of liberal reforms in its satellite state could weaken the communist bloc. The imposition of an authoritarian leadership brought Czechoslovakia back in line with Soviet policies. In 1970, the crippled Apollo 13 spacecraft made it back to Earth safely despite damage done mid-flight by an exploding oxygen tank. On this day in 1971, leaders of what would become the People's Republic of Bangladesh formed a government in exile in India. Later that year, after a bloody war, Bangladesh gained recognition of its independence from Pakistan. In 1975, soldiers of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge marched unopposed into the capital, Phnom Penh, ending 5 years of civil war. Residents of the city celebrated, but within hours, the joy would turn to horror as the hardline Khmer Rouge began to implement a murderous plan to build a utopian communist society. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the United Nations prepares to send a peacekeeping force to end the intercommunal fighting that has torn apart the Central African Republic and created a humanitarian crisis there, the United States is stepping up its engagement to help restore peace and stability. On April 8th, a delegation of U.S. religious leaders representing several faiths traveled to the CAR to meet with their counterparts there and government officials. Led by the U.S. Special Envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Rashad Hussein, the group stressed the solidarity between religious communities in our two countries. It also urged interfaith cooperation to promote dialogue on greater religious tolerance and national reconciliation. Sources of the conflict in the CAR are many, but much of the fighting has taken on a sectarian character as anti-Bellica militias began attacking Muslim civilians in retaliation for Seleka rebel abuses. The violence has caused tens of thousands to flee their homes in the capital, Bangui, and the western half of the country. The U.S. delegation visited a mosque and the cathedral in Bangui, met with representatives of international aid groups, members of civil society, officials of the government led by transitional President Catherine Samba Panza, as well as with representatives of the Seleka and Anti-Bellica. In a communique signed April 8th in Bangui, the parties renounced violence as a tool to resolve disputes and appealed to all citizens to disarm. They expressed appreciation for the role of the religious authorities at the national and local levels to try to pacify relations between religious communities and prevent violence. They further encouraged intercommunity and interreligious dialogues to mitigate tensions and lay the foundations for a new, peaceful coexistence. Lastly, they asked the transitional authorities to implement the Republic Covenant, signed by the transitional government on November 7, 2013, as a credible framework for promoting an inclusive national dialogue between all parties in the country. This should serve as the foundation for a new, peaceful coexistence. The United States is committed to promoting such dialogue as it continues other forms of assistance. We have pledged up to $100 million this year to support African Union troops and the French forces supporting them in their efforts to restore security to the people of CAR. In addition, we are providing $67 million this year to address the humanitarian needs of the CAR population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.